This is Otis M. Carson. I'm from NYC, and you're listening to WGXC Acra Hudson Catskill.
Network, this is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre, and we have a busy WGXC morning show for you today. You've tuned in to a community conversation about things going on here locally. We're going to hear from author Layla Phillip. She talked with Justin Maiman about beavers and their impact on the Hudson Valley recently. We're also going to hear from WOOC's Mark Dunley, who spoke with Russ Haven of the New York Public Interest Research Group about the new right to repair law that Governor Kathy Hochul signed recently. Plus, we'll hear the Better Weather from the Catskill Maker Syndicate and national headlines from the Public News Service. And it all starts after Jason Martin from Troy has finished singing this song. Then it's time for the local news on the WGXC Morning Show. Stay tuned.
Turns the blood. A stream runs through. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. And the moon turns the blood. A stream runs through. And the moon turns the blood. This is the network. Network. And the moon turns the blood. A stream runs through. And the moon turns the blood. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network.
On the WGXC community calendar online at WGXC.org, you can find out about the Ice Skating in the Gilded Age online event that's sponsored by the Hudson Area Library. It's at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, January 24th, and it features Marie Reynolds, the curator at Stottsburg State Park, and an avid ice skater, talking about the history of competitive skating, early indoor ice rinks, fashion, and more about ice skating in New York in the Gilded Age. Go to the WGXC community calendar online to find out the way to get the Zoom link to tune in to Ice Skating in the Gilded Age and add your own event at the WGXC community calendar if you want to hear it read on the radio at WGXC.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by SunCommon, supporting vibrant communities across New York for 15 years, offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Marcus DeGrazia Acupuncture of Austerlitz, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
On Thursday morning, the Coxsackie Athens schools tweeted, quote, "Due to forecast predicting icy conditions this afternoon, especially in the higher elevations of our district, all students will be dismissed at noon today. Lunches will be provided. All after school activities are postponed." The Hunter Tannersville and Wyndham Ashland Jewett schools are also closing early, as is East Greenbush in Rensselaer County. Caro Durham schools are also closing early because of the impending weather. Please be careful on the roads. Conditions are potentially icy as the temperature is hovering around 32 degrees, and there is rain, sleet, freezing rain, all predicted to fall from the sky in the next 24 hours. I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC Daily News for Thursday, January 19th. Go to the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Louis Ferrer Sarduni and Jesse McKinley report for the New York Times that Hector de La Salle, Governor Kathy Hochul's nominee for the state's top judge, was rejected on January 18th by the state Senate Judiciary Committee, the first time New York lawmakers have rejected a governor's choice for chief judge. The 19-member committee voted 10-9 against moving LaSalle's nomination to a full vote on the Senate floor.
So the total is 2 in favor, 10 opposed, and 7 without recommendation. The nomination is lost. Thank you very much.
All 10 who voted against the judge were Democrats. 2 Democrats voted in support of the nomination, while 1 Democrat and all 6 Republicans voted in favor, quote, without recommendation, unquote. However, the rejection does not necessarily mean the matter is concluded. Hochul has not ruled out taking legal action to force a vote on the Senate floor, and she has argued that a committee vote is irrelevant, that her nominee must be subject to a full vote on the Senate floor. Senate Democrats, as well as other legal experts, argue the Senate has the authority to determine its own rules and procedures to consider judicial nominations, especially since the state constitution does not explicitly say a nomination must be voted on by the full state Senate. LaSalle's nomination provoked an intense backlash from progressives. His nomination in December was immediately opposed by several unions, reproductive rights groups, and community organizations, which pointed to cases which they said revealed he was anti-union and anti-abortion. At the hearing on January 18th, LaSalle attempted to dispel what he said were unfair characterizations of his judicial record. Quote, I only ask that this body look at my entire record, not just the record that certain advocates have chosen to look at, unquote, LaSalle said, arguing that some of his cases had been the target of, quote, mischaracterization simply to derail my nomination, unquote. Asked by lawmakers about his judicial philosophy, LaSalle argued that many of the cases that had been singled out had hinged on procedural questions and did not necessarily reflect his underlying beliefs on larger issues involving union rights and abortion. LaSalle is serving as presiding justice of the Appellate Division of the Second Judicial Department of the New York State Supreme Court, which handles civil and criminal appeals from Brooklyn, Queens, Staten Island, Westchester County, and a half dozen other counties. He was considered among the more moderate potential nominees from a list of 7 candidates that Hochul was given to choose from by a special commission as she looked to replace Janet DeFiore, who resigned last year. Read more about this story in the New York Times. Jamel Cutler reports for Columbia Green Media that Columbia County Social Services Commissioner Bob Gibson on January 11th announced his candidacy for Columbia County Judge. Republican Gibson is a graduate of Albany Law School and has been engaged in the practice of law since 2000. He is a resident of Kinderhook, where he was born and raised. Gibson has been Commissioner of Social Services since 2017, and early in his career he served as an assistant in the office of the Columbia County District Attorney. Gibson is the brother of former U.S. Representative Chris Gibson. Quote, I'm running for county judge to bring my decades of experience and lifetime of community service to work for every citizen of Columbia County, unquote, Gibson said. Quote, from representing children to prosecuting dangerous criminals as an assistant district attorney to helping our most vulnerable citizens as commissioner of social services, my wide and varied background has prepared me well for this important position of trust, unquote. During his time with DSS, Gibson has overseen the prosecution of child abuse and neglect cases. Quote, keeping the children and families of Columbia County safe has been my top priority for many years, unquote, he said. If elected judge, Gibson said his primary goal would be to ensure that everyone in his courtroom is treated with respect and, quote, all parties are heard with impartiality and fairness, unquote. Hudson attorney Michael C. Howard recently announced his intention to seek the Democratic Party nomination to run for Columbia County judge. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Porcupine Soup reports that Columbia Green Community College President Carly Drummer announced January 17th that enrollment for the spring 2023 semester at the SUNY Greenport campus is up. Drummer said, quote, we are happy to say that our enrollment numbers are very strong, with an 8.5% increase in headcount over the start of spring 2022 semester. This is the second semester in a row that the college has seen robust growth in its enrollment numbers, unquote. She said the college has emerged stronger after 2 years of pandemic-related changes and challenges. Quote, in particular, Columbia Green now accommodates students who prefer to take classes virtually, and new micro-credentials are accelerating opportunities to enter the workforce, unquote, Drummer said. The final enrollment numbers will not be known until February. The numbers touted in the announcement refer to enrollment on the first day of classes, January 17th.
Read more about this story at porcupinesoup.com. And read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Thursday, January 19th. Local early morning temperatures range from 29 degrees in Scaticoke to 36 in Kingston. Regional average soil temperature is 34. All those numbers are important. Once again, on the raggedy edge of a water table replenishing rain and dangerous ice and snow is where we find ourselves. The current National Weather Service predictions are based on slightly cooler temperatures than I'm seeing. So, officially, if you hear my voice, be warned that freezing rain and or rain and or snow is on the way this morning. But if the 5 a.m. temperatures hold out, our little region should see a little initial icing, especially in the elevated areas. Those places might see snow or a mix ending in rain after dark. Down at river level, some mixed precipitation should turn to rain by the afternoon, but ending is possible sleet near dark. A high temperature of 34 is expected around 12 p.m. If you head north or west, or the temperature just decides to drop a couple degrees, you could see something different, so you have been warned. Overnight, we ride the line around 33, 34 degrees on the ground, keeping the falling water liquid. Right on through till temperatures max out at 38 degrees at 1 p.m. tomorrow. The hills might get another inch of snow if those dipped temperatures hold out. 29 degrees overnight takes us into a dry-looking Saturday with a high of 35. Light winds put conditions at freezing, so layer up if going out. Sunday looks wettish with a high of 39. Sunset today will be at 4:38 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 7:15 a.m. Looking way up, we see Sunspot 3190 is staring us down. X-class flare chances are at 15%. Solar wind speed is currently 517 kilometers per second at 8.1 protons per milliliter. Radio propagation conditions are currently pretty lame until the stars come out, then fare below 8 megahertz. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 3, quiet. The current sunspot number is 164, and this has been the better weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
Now, from Survival comes an economical do-it-yourself fallout shelter.
Civil defense approved and easy to assemble. Takes just a weekend.
Get maximum protection from nuclear fallout for your family.
See a Survival Shelter today.
WGXC's Justin Maiman from Cairo on his Ginger Radio Show interviewed writer Leela Philip, who has written a definitive book about the beaver and its role in shaping the Hudson Valley and North America. Here's an excerpt of Maiman's interview with Philip about her book, Beaverland, How One Weird Made America.
So there are a lot of factors we don't really fully understand a lot about the social life of beavers. And I think it's partly because, and I write about this in the book, as I would discover, you know, beavers have fascinated us for millennium, for centuries, and every continent that there are beavers, people have been fascinated by them. But we tended to study their constructions because they're so brilliant, right? They make these amazing dams and lodges. But the animal itself, only recently have people really started to study the animal. So what we don't know about the beaver probably outweighs what we do.
So what could you tell me about the beavers that you see on a daily or a weekly basis?
Gosh, there's so many ways to answer that question. It's such a wonderful question. I mean, they are wonderfully weird. And the other day someone said, you know, what's weird about a beaver? And I said, well, I think I'll flip that and tell me what isn't weird about a beaver, because they have these beautiful bear-like faces. Then you move down their body and they seem very much like, you know, a seal almost in the water. They're incredibly dynamic and they have these then dexterous hands with 5 very nimble fingers, and they have naked palms. So when you watch beavers manipulating twigs or doing things with their fingers, like they can eat food very delicately, they just seem human-like. It's extraordinary. And I have a lot of fun describing that in the book. But then you move down and they have these huge goose-like feet, and then this really crazy tail that looks like it's been run over, you know. And it looks like it has scales, but that is not, those are not scales. That's actually skin. And the tail is so filled with blood vessels that it's incredibly sensitive to temperature changes. It acts as a kind of air conditioner in the summer. It helps cool the beaver. It helps the beaver understand if the water pressure has changed. And then it's this rudder. So the beavers swim using their tail. And beavers never walk backwards. They kind of will rise up and sort of rest on their tail. So they use it as a prop. They're just fantastic animals. I mean, there are many amazing, wonderful animals in the world. But to me, one of the things that was, I think, very exciting to discover about beavers, and I really leaned in on in the book, was they're this kind of ordinary miracle. You know, they've been so taken for granted or considered a pest or a nuisance. And yet they are the only animal besides humans that construct their world. So they're brilliant. And in fact, they can build in flood conditions better than we can. So, you know, one of the researchers that I write about at Harvard, who was studying beavers for her dissertation in engineering, she was positioned in a lab that studies robotics in part. And it was really interesting because in talking to her, she was saying, you know, if you could figure out the algorithm and program a bot to do what a beaver does in a high flood situation, that would be a super handy thing for humans. So I think scientists and engineers are pretty excited by the things that beavers can potentially teach us. But I should say, using traditional metrics of intelligence, what's called the EQ ratio, which is kind of like a brain-body ratio that we've always used to look at animals, beavers don't rank very high. They're like lower than a squirrel. So we don't understand fully how they do what they do. And that's one of the fun mysteries about them. And, you know, not to be coy, as you know, because I think you've read the book, I write about this. And this researcher at Harvard is starting to, I think, crack the code of beaver intelligence by thinking about their intelligence in a different way, not so much as the intelligence of an individual animal, but the intelligence of a collective. And I think that's pretty fascinating.
So I have so many follow-ups, but I'd like to be in here. You just brought up this idea of the collective intelligence of beavers. And can you just specifically talk about what exactly that is for a moment? Because it's pretty incredible.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it's possible that beavers have a kind of intelligence that is closer to something like ants or termites or bees, and is a kind of intelligence that we don't readily understand or connect to, because we think about things in terms of our own intelligence, which is cognition, right, from an individual brain. But something like termites will build large constructions based on environmental clues. So an individual termite is arguably not very smart, but they are following simple rules and responding to clues from the environment. Literally, termites will leave hormonal scents for one another that basically say, build here. And this researcher at Harvard has made the case that really beavers are responding to environmental clues, and she's identified some of them. And in that respect, by working together, following simple rules, they can build these extraordinary dams, for example. So we know that the largest animal construction seen from space, because it's been seen by satellite, is a beaver dam. It's over a half a mile long. I mean, that's longer than the Hoover Dam. That is really big. And it has endured for decades. So these are constructions that one single beaver could not have built, because a beaver doesn't live for 50 years. So successive generations of beavers have been working on this one site. So then the question is, how do they know to do that? How do they know to go to that place? And she identified one of these environmental cues, and the environmental cues are called stigmergy. So she identified one of these cues as being the volumetric flow rate. So she was studying beavers out in Montana that were building dams after the spring floods. So she wanted to find populations of beavers that were building fresh every year, so she could make sure she could, you know, identify when they were going into the water to build. And beavers don't have measuring equipment, but she did. And she identified that when the current was exactly 250 liters per second, they would go in and start building. And that's exactly the current rate, the flow rate at which their dams could prevail. So they waited until the really heavy runoff was over from the, you know, spring melt from the Rockies, because their dams would have been washed out by those strong currents. But they knew that they needed to build when there was enough water to really capture and swell a pond. You know, if they waited until it was an arid summer condition, they would never get a pond, right? There wouldn't be enough water because it's an arid North Plains situation. So the water's going to dry out. So what they're doing is incredibly brilliant, and it works every time. So she identified some of the environmental cues, and previously it was thought that beavers were cued by the sound of running water, which is probably true, but that can't be the only thing, because no beaver has ever tried to build on Niagara Falls, right? I mean, if they were only cued by the sound of running water, and the louder the water, the more they would try to build, they would then try to build in situations where the shear rate of the water was just too high, and they don't do that. They know when to go in, build, and have their dams prevail. So, and she also argues that we could learn a great deal from beavers in terms of better, more flood-resilient dam design, because beavers don't try to build just one dam to hold all the water. They will build a series of usually three dams or even five. So imagine a succession of dams. So if the first dam breaches, the second dam catches that, and then the third and the fourth. So that force of water during an extreme flood event is being captured and sustained by five dams, right, instead of just one. So, you know, we could probably learn a great deal. And this is something I really write about in the book, that, you know, beavers really have a lot to teach us right now as we face climate change. We almost wiped them out, but they're one of the greatest conservation comeback stories, as I put it, of the 20th century. And they can help us with the greatest crisis of our generation, which is climate change. So floods, fire, drought, all these things, which are pressing problems now and we know are going to get worse. Beavers are in the landscape, and they can really help us with those problems, which I think is, you know, we need stories of hope and resiliency in this moment if we're going to face our collective future and, you know, in a proactive way, and do the things we need to do in time, because we don't have a lot of time.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because there's also, you know, you do strike an optimistic tone in many parts of the book. And one of them especially is when you describe the Hubbard Brook watershed site and what happened there, because for 60 years or so, beavers and the watershed itself was allowed to just be without any, I guess, I don't want to say human interaction. There were humans going in, but without any development or any kind of pushes into this watershed site. Can you talk a bit about what happened during those 60 years in New Hampshire?
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. You know, that was a really, to me, a really important chapter in the book. And I thought a lot about, you know, how am I going to teach readers about, A, what a watershed is, and the really tremendous value of beavers? Because it's not just that they build an individual pond. That pond is part of a river system. And that river system is part of a watershed. So, you know, when rain falls in the watershed anywhere, it needs to end up in those creeks and streams and in the river system. And that water is either stored and cleansed and gets down into, the levels where we can use it, or it rushes back out into the ocean. And so in Hubbard Brook, which was founded in 1955, so for, as you point out, over 70 years, the land has been pretty much untouched. It's almost 8,000 acres. It's an entire watershed, and it's an incredibly important watershed, I should say. That's where acid rain was discovered. So it's been environmentally incredibly important place. So in terms of ecology studies and watershed studies. So going up into the watershed with Dr. Burstead and tromping around after her, what we were witnessing and why I went up there was to see rivers that were, beavers were returning to their, something close to the state before colonization. So these are called paleo rivers. So colonization, which basically starts about 1600, so say 1600 to 1900, geomorphologists now regularly call that the Great Drying, because that's when combination of things like the fur trade, which took out the beaver, and then the timbering of the forests and the resource extraction that went on, and then the, you know, patterns of industrialization really degraded the river system to the extent that we have what we have today, a river system that's not functioning in a healthy way. So we lose a lot of our water. And this is where beavers come in. So it was amazing to see these creeks and streams that in only 70 years, the beavers had built dams and beaver damming complexes in, so that they were starting to move and shift. And instead of being, say, a thin braid of water, what we're used to, a creek or a stream through the woods, they were multi-threaded. Imagine just a like an artery of water or a series of veins that fan out through the woods. And that's what a paleo river looks like. And so the water, when there's spring floods, will flood and overfill the banks. And then when it dries out, it will recede. And that kind of pulsing and rhythmic flooding and contracting is the ecological health of the river system. And that's what the beavers have returned to the watershed. And so it was really fantastic to see what that looked like. It was so different than the streams and creeks I had grown up with. You know, I just, it made it dramatically clear to me that I had grown up in an environment that was highly degraded, and I just didn't understand it. And I really wanted to try to share that with the reader so readers could understand where we are, the work we need to do, and I think the really exciting ways we can harness what beavers are doing to help us. You know, we can't move all our infrastructure. We're not going to move Hartford off the Connecticut River, but there are many, many open areas where we can have beavers. We can let them do what they do. We can let rivers and creeks and streams move more freely and bring a lot more water and function back to our river system. And we need it. I mean, I think the drought last summer taught us a big lesson, even in here in the East, where we get so much rain, you know, we're kind of, I think, unlike the West, which has been so concerned about water for so long, in the East, we've gotten a bit lazy about it, you know, thinking, well, it rains, so we'll always have water. Well, in fact, there was a report from UMass, I think about a week ago, documenting that water levels have really gone down. And so, yes, we may get rain, but if the river system isn't functioning and all that water is just rushing out into the ocean eventually, and it's not getting down into the aquifer, that rain isn't doing what it needs to do. It's not actually hydrating, right, the land. And if the ground gets so dried out, it can't even absorb the water, right? It gets hard packed. Like think of the Dust Bowl, right? That Steinbeck wrote about, right? So I think we are at a moment of reckoning in, on so many levels. And it's really important for us to think about the things we can do right in our own backyard, you know, wherever we live, wherever there are beavers, there is the possibility for better environmental health.
I learned so much from Layla in this book. A couple quick takeaways from me. One, beavers never walk backwards. That is something that will stick with me forever. I guess it seems obvious when you think hard about the beaver tail. Also, that beavers don't really walk. They kind of shuffle on land. They much prefer water. Anyway, that's one of the things. The second is, beavers were really Earth's first engineers. And Layla Philip goes into great detail in the book to talk about the intricate ways beavers construct dams. Also, I wanted to point out that towards the beginning of that conversation, she's talking about this Harvard researcher who has been studying the beaver and talking and thinking about this idea of collective intelligence. That Harvard researcher is Jordan Kennedy. We brought her name up later in the conversation, but it wasn't in that excerpt. So, I'd like to play you a quick snippet of Layla reading from her book. She considers the book science writing, which I think is, of course, true. I might even call it science prose. But there's one moment just towards the beginning of the book where Layla throws all that off and imagines for a moment what it might be like to be this beaver that she is gazing down upon from a bridge. So let me play that.
A quiver on the surface, twitch of grass, and she is frozen. She turns one great webbed foot and grabs the pond's water, slowly turning as if she were a wooden top. Her small brown head with its bear-like ears lifts ever so slightly, the short blunt nose level with the water's surface, black eyes peering. The pond shimmers with insects, green wafts of algae thrum, each cell an engine of chemical reactions. Photosynthesis turning sunlight to sugar, energy into biomass. She waits, floating in the sun-warmed water, senses flaring. Her nostrils widen, taking in the sweet stink of waterlogged weed and wood. Then a new smell, acrid, metallic. Her brain flashes danger, muscles pulse. She flings her head forward, thrusting her back out of the water and dives. On the way down, her tail slams the surface, a paddle crack, a warning. Her head cleaves the water, clear, nictitating membranes shielding her eyes like swimming goggles. She sees through the murk. She is not the predator here, she is prey. She dives and dives, her life a question answered by the speed of her flight. Down she goes, hell-bent for the bottom of the pond. Her body swoops, all muscle now, propelling her through the pond as if following a groove. Her webbed toes spread like sails, grab the water, push. She dodges hazy shapes, sticks and branches, boulders and stones, water lily stalks, and black, thick pond grass. The pond surface now just memory, a distant lid. She seems more fish than mammal now, her tail a rudder, her ears and windpipe sealed from the water. Though the dive slows her heart rate, electric currents of fear zing through her body. Her short front paws scramble, the surprising fingers ripping through the thick strands of water lilies. On the surface, the lilies bloom in elegant profusion of yellow and white. Down here, they are a dark maze through which she must maneuver. She swims deeper, deeper into layers of welcoming silt, her inner lips closed behind her teeth, keeping water from her lungs. The mud-filled water ruffles her mouth, while along her back the dark slurry carries her fur. She feels its weight and pushes harder still. She knows she is almost there. Then, that sudden coolness, like absolution, and she parts the dark curtain. She slows, turns, glides along the canal. Only there, moving along the intricate highway she and others have clawed through the mud on the bottom of the pond, can she rest, swimming slowly through the underwater pathways. Ahead, she senses a rising darkness. She dives once more, then swims up through a tunnel and breaks the surface. She fills her lungs and climbs quickly out into the dome of the lodge, safely home.
This is Signals from C. Feel on the radio at WGXC 90.7 FM. Next, Mark Dunley from our partner station WOOC in Troy speaks with Russ Haven of the New York Public Interest Research Group about the new right to repair law that was passed in the state legislature and signed by the governor recently.
We are joined by Russ Haven, who's the general counsel of NYPIRG, New York Public Interest Research Group. And we wanted to talk to him about one particular issue that he worked on during the most recent legislative session. And that was something called the right to repair. So, Russ, what was this bill about and why is it important to people?
This legislation is actually the first in the nation law or bill at this point until the governor approves it, which we hope she will do. And it gives people the right to have a choice about how to fix their digital devices. And by digital device, I mean your cell phone, your laptop, your tablet. It could be a camera, an electronic camera. So any typical consumer item that has a digital set of electronics embedded in it, and that would be covered by this bill. It doesn't cover things like your washing machine at home or your microwave, but it does cover common consumer products that have digital components, which is a lot of stuff these days.
So would it include, you didn't mention this, but a car, since cars are going, much more electronic. And I remember when I first bought a Prius 15, 20 years ago, having some little challenges with the computer screen, and only place you could deal with it was the dealer.
Yeah, it does not cover automobiles, farm equipment, medical devices, and emergency response technology. Those are four categories that are not covered by the bill. And much of the repairs to automobiles is covered by an agreement among the manufacturers where they would make information and tools and parts available for most repairs. And that's why, for the most part, when you have a problem with your car, you can go to a dealership or you can go to a private mechanic to get the repair work done. But that's not covered by this legislation.
So how did some of the, say computer companies or phone companies, your smartphones, were they a, supportive or opposed to the legislation? And B, I thought they were themselves beginning to loosen in the rules a bit, but I've also heard from some consumers that the way they loosened the rules so far have not been so hot.
Yeah, I think not so hot is a good way to put it. There was a big fight, and this bill, it's 2022. This bill first got introduced back in 2015. And so it's been a 7-year fight, and the bill got, as is often the case, the bill got confined somewhat. It got pared down, where initially it started, there was farm equipment and some other big ticket items included. And that came out. But Apple and Amazon and other companies that produce digital products for consumers, they were vigorously opposed for years and years. I'm not sure they were thrilled with this, but I think the bill got to a place where they realized they could live with it. But I think they were still unhappy. And the reason they're unhappy is because they make an enormous amount of money by either charging consumers to repair their own items, or more likely, they try and get you to upgrade and buy a new one, even though the item could be repaired and perform well for years to come. That's not, they don't view that in their financial interest. So we faced a lot of opposition over the 7 years of this bill's history.
So if you, do go out and repair your own phone or, go to a you know, computer store and have them do it. That does not negate your warranty, which is what, you know, of course, the seller's always trying to say, well, yeah, you can do that. But, you know, if something comes back, forget your warranty is voided at this point.
Well, it wouldn't necessarily void your warranty. If it was done sloppily and somehow you damaged the phone, you still might run the risk of the warranties. But the warranties, by and large, aren't worth very much because they don't have very long lifespans and they don't cover much, and they're just really inconvenient. The reason this bill is so important is, number one, consumers end up they don't have choice, so they end up spending a lot more money to fix stuff. And as I mentioned, they often end up just throwing in the towel and getting a new product. So that means we're overpaying and we're not getting a full life to the products we buy. And as you know, these digital products, they're not cheap. Several hundred dollars, but certainly it can go over $1,000. The other thing is that we're creating an enormous amount of electronic waste. These cell phones and other digital devices, they have toxic metals in them. They have what are called rare earth metals, which are they're expensive and they're toxic. And so we're discarding them at an alarming rate with no real plan on what to do with them once they're in the trash. And they're either, you know, in some cases they get shipped to third world countries where there may be some salvage of useful materials, but more likely it ends up in a landfill, or probably even worse, it ends up in an incinerator where all the toxic constituents are either going out the smokestack or ending up in a highly concentrated toxic ash residue. So there's real environmental aspects to this bill, as well as consumer protections that makes it important. And the other thing about having options, whether you're a do-it-yourselfer or you want to go to your local repair shop, is that it saves people time. And time is really important, because if you want your phone fixed by Apple, or really more likely you don't have a choice, that if you have an iPhone, they're not going to necessarily fix it immediately. They may have to take your phone and ship it to one of their repair centers overseas. Under this law, what we think will happen is that there will be repair shops in every community who can do the work either on a walk-in basis or maybe overnight for common repairs like replacing batteries, replacing screens, and other, you know, typical problems you have with your cell phone, laptop, et cetera.
You also mentioned one of the bills you worked on, and I believe passed, was the wrongful death law. Can you quickly summarize why that's important?
New York has a law in the books that allows loved ones to go to court to seek compensation when a close family member or someone they're close to, their life has been wrongfully taken. It could be by a drunk driver. It could be by a dangerous product. It could be through an act of medical negligence at a hospital or in a doctor's office. And the law has not been changed since 1847. It's 175 years ago. It does not allow New Yorkers to claim emotional losses like the grief and anguish from a death or the loss of the relationship. 48 other states allow those kinds of damages. New York does not. It's New York and Alabama at this point that still are stuck in the mid-1800s. And the other thing it would do is it would expand the classes of people or the types of people who could claim these damages. So now you could be living with your partner, you could be planning to get married, you could share a home and mortgage. But if, God forbid, one of those folks dies, the partner does not have any rights under the law, because technically they're not related by blood or married. And we think that fails to recognize the reality of modern relationships in the 21st century.
Russ, we're out of time. We've been talking with Russ Haven, the general counsel for NYPIRG, NYPIRG.org. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
On Thursday morning, the Coxsackie Athens schools tweeted, quote, "Due to forecast predicting icy conditions this afternoon, especially in the higher elevations of our district, all students will be dismissed at noon today. Lunches will be provided. All after-school activities are postponed." The Hunter Tannersville and Wyndham Ashland Jewett schools are also closing early, as is East Greenbush in Rensselaer County. Caro Durham schools are also closing early because of the impending weather. Please be careful on the roads. Conditions are potentially icy as the temperature is hovering around 32 degrees, and there is rain, sleet, freezing rain, all predicted to fall from the sky in the next 24 hours. From the 2021 album The Piano Equation, this is Radio Signals Equation from Matthew Shipp.